Liverpool-based artist Ben Solee is only 24, but he's already thinking about his final wishes.
When I'm gone now, bury me with my car. When I'm gone, bury me with my car. Cause if anywhere is wherever I end up when I'm gonna need my ride, get around. So please, please, bury me with my car.
You wouldn't know it from this fiddle-heavy tune, but Ben Solee is a classically trained cellist. Strings of all sorts strum on his second album. It's called Learning to Bend. There's the viola, the banjo, and even a harp. Solee came to the national scene with the Sparrow Quartet, where he plays with Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. He joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Ben Solee.
Hi, Angie.
So what kind of car are you going to be buried in?
I've been thinking about this. I think one of those old steel ones, like an old Buick or maybe an old Cadillac.
You go on to sing, "In America, they'll bury us with our car."
Yeah. I went on a whim to a lecture at the University of Louisville where I attended school, and it was this Egyptologist that was talking about Cheops' boat. The legend was that Cheops had been buried with 8 or 9 boats, and they were buried with these boats so that they could either get into the other world or to actually get around on the other side. And so I did some research, and I found some Romans were buried with their chariots, Roman warriors. China's first emperor was buried with that whole terracotta army. Hmm. And I just thought about, in our culture, what would we preserve ourselves in if we needed to get around on the other side?
I'm telling you, mine's going to be a minivan.
You'll have plenty of room.
I want to hear a track from the CD that shows off the talent that Ben Solee, you're most known for, which is playing the cello. Let's listen to, this is called A Few Honest Words.
If you're going to lead my country, if you're going to say it's free, I'm going to need a little honesty. It shouldn't be that hard. Just a few honest words is all I need.
Ben Solee, you're plucking this cello.
Yeah. When I started playing cello, I started in public schools. I was the only cellist in my orchestra for 2 years, so I didn't really have anybody sitting next to me being like, this is how it's played. And my dad was a guitarist, and I was always trying to play fiddle tunes with my grandfather. Really, my classical training didn't really happen until college.
There's a wide range of styles that you play the cello and songs that you write on this album. Let's listen to It's Not Impossible.
I can't change the way you live. All I wanted was to say goodbye. I was scared, you know, and I was mad, you know, but boys don't cry, boys don't cry.
This is a pop song.
Yeah, it needed to be a little poppy because it's a popular thing for boys to be tougher, to not cry. I mean, I know there were so many times when I was younger, it was just like, why are you crying? Well, because, okay, I'll stop. And after a while of that, it's not even about feeling bad about crying. It just becomes ingrained in us, and we lose that outlet of expression, and then we end up letting it out in other ways, like tuning cars and taking things and breaking things, none of which I've done.
It's not impossible for me to cry. It's just the hardest thing I've ever done.
Ben Solee, how do you write a pop song for the cello?
I don't know.
I mean, to me, I can imagine some guy with a guitar kind of picking around in his basement or in his room working on a song. But when you have the cello, how do you imagine all the pieces coming together of a pop song?
Well, that's a bigger thing. I mean, it's the consciousness of how people think of the cello. If you think of a cello, you think of it in what setting? It's probably with an orchestra. Mm-hmm. What kind of music is it playing? It's playing classical music. Who's playing it? Some guy in a tuxedo. You know, it's like this part of this bigger stigma of the cello. And it's really just a wooden box with strings on it. And if you write a song and want to have an expression and you want to just the cello to be a rhythm instrument to help drive it along, you should be able to do that with a little bit of time and just ingenuity. The old American way, you should be able to do it.
The one cover song on the album is Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come.
Well, it's dark in the city, I've lost my pride. The lights in the streets hide the stars from my eyes. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. And it's too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there, just beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. And I miss my family, my little girl. She is my princess, I'd give her the world. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come.
You changed some of the words.
I changed some of the words. I really resonate with what he's saying in the song. It's an inherent belief in the inherent good of human beings. And I share that conviction. But I didn't really feel like, as a white boy from Kentucky, I could totally understand and take further what a black man was feeling in the 60s. And so I took it the way I could. And it's just, I took it the direction of trying to find some peace in this world.
My favorite song on this album is called Panning for Gold.
I saw God by the river, panning for gold. I saw God by the river, weary and old. He said, son, I used to know where I put things. I used to know.
It's such a melancholy idea of God losing track of things.
The song isn't so much about religion and spiritualism as much as it is just about aging. Both my grandparents are dealing with dementia right now. Mm. And they've just sort of forgotten all that they created and did. I simply use the character of God and the idea that if he created everything, he could potentially forget that he created it, and then it would be up to us to show him the beauty that he created.
I saw God in the forest, teaching Tai Chi to the trees and the wind, and bowing to the sea. He said, son, I used to know where I put things. I used to know.
Ben Sully's new album is called Learning to Bend. Thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely, Andrea. Thank you.
To hear more of Ben Sully's work, check out the music section of our website at npr.org.
Shown all the beauty in the world, but now I need show me. Yeah. Show me.
In Nashville, you can hear the chords of competitive barbershop quartet. Tomorrow, the Barbershop Harmony Society will crown one quartet its international champion. Nearly 10,000 people have been in Nashville this week for the event, but it is not entirely harmonious, as Blake Farmer reports from member station WPLN.
In a hotel lobby this week, a foursome broke out in song.
Down our way.
Judging by their name tags, one of them is from New Hampshire, two from New York, another from Georgia. Despite geographic diversity, they all know this song, Down Our Way, because it's a standard for barbershop. It can be found in the Polecat book, which is like the barbershop hymnal. But behind the singing, there's been a good-natured squabble about the 70-year-old Harmony Society's future. The new chief executive, Ed Watson, says it keeps him busy.
All the time, believe me. I really believe that the kibbers, we call them kibbers, keep it barbershop, want the same thing that the libbers, which is the liberal interpretation of barbershop.
The kibbers and the libbers.
The kibbers and the libbers. What we want to see is a thriving and healthy protection of a barbershop, a style of music, go off into the future as something that is viable and can still stand on its own.
The Society's numbers have fallen in recent decades to roughly 28,000, down from a peak of 40,000. The group has evolved. For starters, it shortened the name and recently opened up competition to more modern songs, like this arrangement from the quartet O.C. Times.
She'll have fun, 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 Daddy takes the T-bird away.
Still not that modern.
We had a quartet a few years ago sing ABC 123 by Michael Jackson. ABC, 1, 2, 3. That's not a good barbershop vehicle. But they did it, and they did not get disqualified for it. Now, the audience didn't particularly like it.
And that's the challenge, balancing the preservation of an art form while appealing to a younger generation. Guys like retiree Jack Martin think the Society's gone too far in trying to get with the times.
I happen to be one of many that has difficulty in telling you what barbershop is, but I can sure tell you when it isn't.
Martin chairs a group of 300 hardliners who call themselves the Barbershop Quartet Preservation Association. He and his compatriots are still part of the Harmony Society, but he estimates roughly 20% of the Society's members share his persuasion to keep barbershop the way it is, or was.
Welcome, welcome, everyone.
At a rehearsal of Nashville's Music City Chorus ahead of the big convention, the men go through a routine with stage smiles so big they must hurt.
Like to make you comfy, cozy.
Barbershop's unique sound comes from having the tenor line above the lead and heavy use of seventh chords. 1, 3, 5, 7. Freeman Grote has been singing barbershop so long he actually learned in a barbershop. He says that every guy lives to experience what's called the expanded sound, or the fifth voice, which is created by overtones.
When you go into a shower stall or someplace in a bathroom and you start singing, and all of a sudden you hear, ooh, boy, that sounded big.
It kind of gives you goosebumps sort of thing. When it hits right.
Oh, yeah.
We call it locking in.
25-year-old Aaron Moss has been barbershopping little more than a year. While he enjoys the more modern songs, he doesn't make much of the kibber-libber dispute.
No two people who are singing together can hate each other in the moment.
But in a group where the average age is well into retirement years, generational issues are a problem. Voices closer in age blend better. While Moss would like to start a quartet of his own, he hasn't found enough guys under 30 to join him. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
Peace up. A-Town down.
Atlanta is home to some of the biggest stars in hip-hop and R&B, from Outkast to Usher and Lil Jon. Since the 1990s, though, the city has been nurturing a different scene, a scene independent from the music industry, and a scene that grew out of the spirit of the civil rights movement.
I am not my head. I am not the skin.
Today we begin a series on local music scenes with this story from Joel Rose, who went in search of Atlanta's independent soul.
A tour of Atlanta's soul scene begins, oddly enough, in Midtown, in the shadow of high-rise condos and generic office towers.
We show you the corporate headquarters, the global headquarters for Coca-Cola.
That's where they keep the secret formula?
That's where they keep the secret formula, man.
My guide is Jamal Ahmed, a radio DJ at Clark Atlanta University's WCLK, and about the closest thing there is to an historian of the scene.
Georgia Tech right here. This is the heart of Atlanta, right here.
Ahmed turns left into the parking lot of the Varsity, a landmark burger joint.
It still has the kind of 50s motif where they bring the food out to you. People come from far and wide just to eat their burgers.
Most of those people probably have no idea they're a few hundred feet from the birthplace of Atlanta's independent soul scene. The Yin Yang Cafe opened its doors in 1994 in a former laundromat on a dead-end street. The club helped launch dozens of local artists, including India Arie. I'm the average girl from your video.
We all felt like we didn't want to do what was considered regular R&B at the time, as before anyone was saying neo-soul. We knew that we wanted to have control over our music and try alternative routes of getting our music out there.
Arie burst onto the national stage in 2001 when her debut album earned 7 Grammy nominations. But when she started singing at the Yin Yang Cafe, she was just another songwriter with an acoustic guitar. Before long, Arie and some of the other performers got together to form an artists' collective called Groovement. Jamal Ahmed was a member, too. He says the collective felt empowered, in part, by the legacy of the civil rights movement.
The civil rights movement instilled, like, this sense of greatness amongst the young African-American community. Me being from Atlanta, that was something that was always instilled in us in school and through our parents, because our parents were part of that protest generation.
The music of Groovement members looked back to the classic soul singers of the 1960s and 70s, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and Donny Hathaway. But the Groovement artists also drew on the international sounds they heard on WCLK, acid jazz and new soul from Europe, and remixes from Japan. They brought all of those influences to the tiny stage at the Yin Yang Cafe.
It was really the incubator for all of us.
Singer and songwriter Anthony David says the club was a hole in the wall that could barely hold 300 people, but it gave young musicians a chance to get up in front of an audience.
I didn't play music when I started going there. I would just go and watch. So probably over a period of 5 years, I went from not playing to playing.
You really do sing the thing that you can just do. Protecting us from crime, but who's protecting us from you?
Anthony David and India Arie say indie soul drew packed houses to the Yin Yang.
It was like we were already stars because you had an audience of people who were there singing all the words to your songs. It was like you had music on the radio, and it really helped to boost all of our confidence.
But inevitably, the new scene went through some growing pains. Jamal Ahmed and Anthony David quit the collective. India Arie signed to a major label. And perhaps most painful of all, the Yin Yang Cafe closed. Not because it wasn't successful, but because the landlord wanted to sell it.
It was like you could hear a needle drop.
DJ Kemet stood behind the turntables for hip-hop pioneers Arrested Development and the Yin Yang's house band, The Chronicle.
Once Yin Yang was gone, it was kind of like everybody was caught with their pants down and looking around, like, where are we going to meet? How are we going to do this?
Kemet says a few promoters put on occasional shows around town, but he says the scene lost its center, and a lot of artists retreated to the solitude of their studios.
It hurt the scene, and at the same time, I guess it allowed different musicians and producers to go in to our little caves and hone in and really, really get our craft to the best of our ability.
Kemet says it went on like that for more than 2 years, but But now the soul scene in Atlanta seems to be rising from its own ashes, kind of like the city itself.
Jazz 91.9, we are the jazz of the city. I'm Jamal Ahmed, and you're checking out the soul of jazz on this Thursday afternoon here in the city of the ATL.
WCLK is playing more indie soul now. The room that used to be the Yin Yang reopened as the Apache Cafe, and a handful of new clubs are presenting indie soul. On Thursday nights, the jam session is at the upscale Harlem Bar, where a beer and bottled water will cost you $12, and the kitchen serves fancy soul food until 2 in the morning. Vocalist Julie Dexter is sitting in with the house band, singing to a well-dressed crowd of African Americans, most of them under 40. Dexter says she had to move here from London 8 years ago.
Never been to a place where I had seen black people on all levels, not just in sports and music, but lawyers, business owners, rich neighborhoods where black people lived and had beautiful houses and cars. That was new to me, coming from England.
The most ambitious of Atlanta's new soul clubs is called Sugar Hill. It's co-owned by Freddie Luster, who used to own the Yin Yang. Luster says Sugar Hill is doing fine, though not quite as well as the hip-hop club he co-owns.
So we joke, this is the love, that's the money. I mean, this place pays its bills, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's doing well. But the model is different, you know what I mean? This is a true reflection on who we are. The other place is profit center.
There's little doubt that Atlanta is a hip-hop town, first and foremost, and that soul occupies a smaller niche. But to some, the intimacy of the Atlanta soul scene is one of its charms. Far from traditional music industry towns like New York and Los Angeles, singer Julie Dexter says artists here can afford to experiment.
Here, I find that people will give you more of a chance to grow, to get to where you're trying to get to. I feel like in New York, you got to be where you're supposed to be before you can step out. Go and shed somewhere else. Atlanta is a good place to develop, grow, get your groove on, find out what your voice is.
With a little luck, that voice will also resonate beyond Atlanta. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You can hear performances from the Atlanta clubs and read a personal essay about the music scene there at npr.org. It's in the music section. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We heard yesterday from the Welsh soul singer Duffy. She's one in a new crop of British women singer-songwriters. Today, 18-year-old Laura Marling. She came into our New York studios and told me she understands that people will lump her in with other contemporary female British singers, but she says they're a gender, not a genre.
It's not an insult, but it's it's strange because we come from completely different places. The only thing we have in common is that we're female.
It seems as though in some ways you've sort of tried to resist the image-based, mainstream commercial success that many other musicians strive for. How do you approach your career in that sense?
I just think of everything I do in how happy it will make me to do it. I don't like having my photograph taken, for instance, so I don't do that often, and I play guitar and sing, and that's my thing. I'm not much of a talker. So if there's a chance for me to play my guitar and sing, I'm there.
Do you have your guitar there? You want to play something for us?
Yeah, sure. This is called Cross Your Fingers.
Look down on the body that you have grown. For mountains stand around you, they're not your own. And light squares and bodies are all you see. Since you broke down, since I broke down, since we broke down, I jump into your grave and die.
What's that meeting like where you tell Virgin Records, actually, no, I'm not going to have my photo on the album jacket?
If they ever tried to make me do anything like that, I would down tools.
Is that a British expression? I'm not familiar with it.
Down tools. Stop working. Ah. I've put the guitar down. Music, the music industry is whatever you want it to be. If you want to be mega famous, you're going to have to do things that people tell you until you get mega famous, and then you can tell everybody what to do.
As you've gotten bigger, have there been moments that people have said, no, we need you to do this, and you've said, that's just not going to happen?
Yeah, of course, of course. And you just have to stay in control. And I've got... I think I'm lucky because my dad ran a studio when we were growing up and ran a recording studio, so I knew a bit about... You know, I've always had a bit of sort of know-how about it. So I'm bloody lucky, really. And I stay in control because it is my career, it's just sort of common sense, really.
Are you crawl out of the sea, stayed into my arms, stayed into my arms.
I understand when you started your national tour about a year and a half ago, there was a concert that you were actually not allowed to play because you weren't old enough. Will you tell me that story?
It was my first UK tour. And we'd all been travelling around the country in this, you know, rubbish old van. And then we got to London and we went in, we sound checked. I was in the dressing room and the manager of the club came in and said, do you have any ID? And I said, no, he said that his bouncer had read in the paper that I was playing here tonight and that I was 17. And the reason that it was such a big deal, they usually don't really care in England, but it was because it was a gay strip club. And they had a strip license, so I couldn't go in.
But a crowd had formed to hear you.
So my band, I was obviously really upset because we'd sold out the gig. I mean, it was only 200 capacity. And my band just marched outside, and we played on the street outside two sex shops in Soho. It was really fun. I was running off adrenaline from that gig for like weeks after.
Your performance style has been described as stare intensely at a spot on the floor. How do you feel about performing for people?
I love it. I used to get horrendously nervous. I didn't love it when I was a nipper.
The 18-year-old says.
Yeah. But I've grown to love it. It's like an exciting fear.
What's it a fear of?
Playing in front of a room full of people.
Well, will you play something else for us, given that we're in an intimate little studio with a mere handful of people?
This is called The Less I Cannot Swim. There's a house across the river, but alas, I cannot swim. And a garden of such beauty that the flowers seem to grin. There's a house across the river, but alas, I cannot swim. I live my life regretting that I never jumped in. It's a certain amount of fantasy. There being this particular formula for living and for having a real life that I haven't done because I left school, I didn't go to university, I didn't enjoy school at all, but I loved literature and I loved music and that's what I knew I loved. But because I didn't take the exams, you know, I think it's basically my insecurity about not having finished my school years. There's a life across the river that was meant for me. Instead, I live my life in constant misery. There's a life across the river, but I do not see why I should please those who will never be pleased. You know, you are what you can prove you've done. That's how people judge you. You know, I've released an album, so I can prove to people that I was a songwriter. And people who've finished university can prove to people that they've got a degree and they've worked for something. And I think, like, I love so many things, but I haven't got any qualifications. You know, apart from the album is my qualification, I guess. There is gold across the river, but I don't want none. I would rather be dry than held up by a golden gun. Saying work more, earn more, live more, have more fun. Saying work more, earn more, live more, have more fun. Saying work more, earn more, live more, have more fun.
That's Laura Marling playing Alas, I Cannot Swim, the title track from her new album, and it's a hidden track on the album.
Yeah. You gave the game away there.
Oh, I'm sorry. And you can hear more of Laura Marling's songs at the music section of NPR.org.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Steve Inskeep is back on Monday. And Renee, it's been a pleasure hosting with you these last couple of weeks.
And it's been a pleasure having you sort of next to me, 3,000 miles away, in the host chair there in D.C.
Forgive me, I am only a man.